Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Beyond the Optics podcast with your host, Tulip Nandu. I'm a computational biologist at UT Southwestern Medical Center, an avid traveler, a blogger, and now a podcast host. Similar to my role as a researcher, which expects me to take an in-depth look at the projects I'm working on, I'm also curious to go beyond the optics for everything that is happening around and to leverage that knowledge to challenge the status quo and think from a different perspective. This podcast is an attempt by me to put the information out there and spark a curiosity amongst the listeners to go beyond the optics and not take the material they are fed at face value. We are going to start with a mini-series on money, its evolution from the barter era, and how the current crisis have raised questions on the monetary and fiscal policies that were undertaken. To get a good handle on the topic, we have an erudite scholar in the subject on the pod, Professor Peter Lewin. He's a clinical professor of finance and managerial economics and the director at the Center for the Analysis of Property Rights and Innovation at the University of Texas at Dallas. He's the author of multiple books on finance and economics, and his academic interests align in Austrian economics, capital theory on the economics of discrimination, the economics of the family. Thank you, Professor Lewin, for being a part of my pod and also being the first guest on my show.
Thank you, Tulip. I'm honored to be here.
Let's start with a sneak peek into how your journey from South Africa, where you started your education, and then your thesis on apartheid, and how you got engaged in this world of economics and finance. What was that tipping point, or at least your encouragement that got you here?
Okay, well, I was born in 1948 in Johannesburg, South Africa. That was a very momentous year for South Africa, for the world as well, but particularly for South Africa, because that was the year in which the nationalist government came to power and established the social policy known as apartheid. So I grew up in a pretty average middle-class family in Johannesburg, of course, being a member of the white population. Although my ancestry is Jewish, the Jews of South Africa, who actually have played a very prominent part in South Africa's economic development, all of whom pretty much white, so they were part of the white population. And I lived in, my father was an accountant. My mother was a kind of secretary, classic underachiever, given the role of women back then. Mm-hmm. And from a very young age, I somehow realized I wanted to be an economist. A friend of mine's mother was a politician, and she said, oh, economics is very important. If you really want to know about the world, you have to know about economics. And she must have told us something about it, but somehow I just stuck with me. And I, from that time on, I wanted to study economics. I just felt like it was that intersection between artistic endeavors and scientific endeavors. And so I went to the local university in Johannesburg called the University of the Witwatersrand. White Waters Rand is the translation. It refers to the gold reef, actually, that runs under Johannesburg and was the basis of gold mining and really the wealth of South Africa in the modern world. And it was the biggest university in the country. It was known as a liberal university in the meaning of perhaps the European meaning of that word liberal. And I studied economics and history. I was really pleased that I got to study history, although that was an accident. I did that so I could avoid going into the army. They were looking for teachers, and I was drafted into the armed forces. And my parents were trying to find an angle to get me out. And one of the angles was that if you study teaching, since they feed this kind of central planning, politicians felt that the country needed teachers. So I became a history major, and an economics major, dual major, so that I could say that I was studying teaching. But it turned out to be the best thing that could ever have happened, because the two are really inextricably linked. One of the problems, perhaps we will discuss later, of modern economic thinking is that modern economists are not trained in either the history of economic thought or in history general. And it's a problem plaguing America today, is that the young people don't know enough history, and what they think they know is wrong. Anyway, I graduated in economics and history, and then I left in September of 1972 for the University of Chicago to do my PhD. At the time, in my honors year, I did a thesis, an honors thesis on the monetary economics of Milton Friedman. And I'd started reading Friedman already as an undergraduate. I read his columns in Newsweek, and I read his book, Capitalism and Freedom. So I read his political writings, and then I started reading his monetary work on the optimum quantity of money and other essays, and the dollars and deficits, a popular work, which, by the way, contains a number of essays which were speeches given in India. So I knew who Friedman was, and I wrote a thesis on his monetary work. And so I left for Chicago in September. A week later, I was sitting in Friedman's class. As I was prepared in monetary theory, I had a good grounding in economics in general, micro and macro, and international trade, welfare economics. Because in South Africa, I was taught by the German economist, Ludwig Lachmann. He was from Germany, but he was an adherent to, a proponent of, the Austrian school of economics. He had studied with Hayek. He had met Mises. So he was one of those Germans who sort of kept contact with Austria and came to South Africa via England. And so I had a fantastic grounding from him and from some very good teachers in South Africa. I had a good technical background. When I went to Chicago, then I studied with some of the greatest economists in the world at the time, Milton Friedman, George Stigler, Ted Schultz, and then, of course, Gary Becker, who was just then come to the University of Chicago. He was the sort of young prince. He had come from Columbia, and he was sort of a young student, the younger student of Friedman. He wrote his doctoral thesis on the economics of discrimination. And although I had specialized in monetary theory in South Africa, and I already passed my field exam at Chicago in my first year in money, I somehow felt that it was obvious for me to take the opportunity to work with Becker, coming from South Africa, where there was the apartheid policy, and Becker had written this book on the economics of discrimination. It seemed like a natural fit. So I did my thesis on the economics of apartheid, and I got to work with Gary Becker, which was wonderful. And then I eventually graduated in 1979 and then came to Dallas, and I've lived in Dallas ever since.
That's a great insight. And that probably is a good way to start, because people who are listening should know a background like as great as yours, and learning, like as you mentioned, history and economics, which will give a good segue into our next section of monetary theory, or getting to know more about money. Why not we start with a brief journey of money, and how did the concept of money come into picture, like from the barter era to the current money in the form of print notes that we have today?
I was always fascinated by the idea of money, and really, you could say, cut my teeth on that. I read a whole lot, but more recently have moved away a little bit into the area, as you mentioned, of capital theory, capital and finance. And, you know, part of the reason for that is that I became disillusioned not with the with monetary theory, which I still think is fascinating, but with macroeconomics. And, you know, let me put it this way. Anybody listening to this podcast who finds money or the world of money and the world of finance mysterious and complicated and confusing can be forgiven, because really there are so many unknowns and the complexities are so great when we're dealing with a system as gigantic as the modern economy and as intricate in terms of the number of moving parts, that I think disillusionment with macroeconomics can be easily understood. And a lot of theorists who are working in macroeconomics have sort of grasped onto rather convoluted, unrealistic models that have made it even more difficult to understand what is going on. Which is, at some point, I just came to the conclusion, pretty much everything that can be said, pretty much everything that can be known about monetary theory and monetary economies, how money works in economies, has been said. And so while I think there are a lot of things we can understand about money, particularly what you ask me, its origins and how it developed, I want to reassure the audience that if they find macroeconomics complicated and confusing, they're in very, very good company and they should not despair, but go back to the first principles, which is what I'm going to try to lay out. So money can best be understood as a social institution. Social is clear. The word institution does not refer to anything physical. You know, sometimes the word in English, institution, people think of a building or a, you know, an organization or something. Mm-hmm. But there are some organizations that can be referred to as institutions, but most social institutions are not organized. They have evolved. Institutions in that sense refer to ways of doing things, the way that we interact, mostly without even knowing that we do. And money is one of those. People are prone in the 20th and 21st centuries, maybe starting the 19th century, age of reason in the 1700s, to think about the achievements of our modern world, the greatly enriched modern world, as the products of science, and therefore the products of the human mind. You know, that fantastic discoveries and collaborations, we think of these marvelous constructs. And then they look at money and they think, well, what government was so enlightened as to be able to impose, create such a wonderful institution as money? It's like, who invented money? And this sort of portrays the naivete or the misguided way in which we think about this. Just like saying, who invented language? Which, of course, nobody invented language. We're quite comfortable with the idea that as complex and as wonderful as language is, it is not something that anybody put together, because it is so complicated. It has such structural complexity, such structural intricacy, language. And yet it kind of rolls off the tongue, right? That there's so many miracles taking place between the brain and the mouth and all this, that we're in awe, but we don't think it's so complicated that we realize nobody could have created language, designed it. There was an attempt to design language. called Esperanto. Esperanto. They wanted to put together a logical formal language. It was a complete failure. They managed to put it together, but nobody wanted to speak it. Language is inevitably spontaneous. it's beautifully structured, but at the same time, creatively unruly. The world of money is like that. Money was not invented by anybody. Money, in fact, is quite analogous, not as complicated as, but quite analogous to the idea of language. Because trade is a form of enhanced communication. And what money is a way that human beings accidentally discovered to enhance and multiply trade. And they did this in a world of barter in which there were many things perhaps traded, but some things were more reliably and often traded than others. Notably, you know, certain basic foodstuffs, certain precious metals, because they had a certain advantage in keeping their form and their purity. They didn't spoil, and they were traded often, and people got used to their exchange value. So that when somebody wanted to trade, say, meat for fish, and was worried that they couldn't find somebody who had fish and wanted meat, they would be inclined to accept maybe copper for their meat, because they knew that copper was widely traded, and they knew that it was already valued. And they could then take a longer time trying to locate somebody who had fish for sale and would sell fish. And the minute somebody does that, the minute they accept something, not for its own sake, but in order to use it to exchange for something else, that thing becomes money for them. So money is really trading in a monetary economy is what we call indirect exchange. Trading in a barter economy is what we call direct exchange. And there's nothing particularly complicated about that. Anybody sort of hearing the story can relate to that, can understand very easily what this idea of money is. Because if you just come to it without thinking about its origins, it seems very mysterious. Why would we all accept these worthless pieces of paper, right? Mm-hmm. Where does that come from? But then if you think about how somehow every single money that has ever existed in now or in the past must have evolved from something that once was not money, from some commodity that already had value. And notice, Tulip, there's nothing in this about government. You know, it's not all of it. Don't need government to establish the value for money. It's only when governments get involved that we have a problem with the value of money. Before government gets involved in money, money has its own self-evident value. It's the value that everybody puts upon it as a commodity. And then add to that the demand for that because people want to use that as a medium of exchange. And so it has an enhanced value. And then, you know, it's kind of inconvenient to take around copper if you want to trade. It's heavy and it's bulky. So you give your copper to somebody who's prepared to keep it safe for you, who has a reputation, and they give you a receipt and they put their stamp on the receipt. And pretty soon the receipts are trading as paper money. And that, in a nutshell, is how we got modern monies. From that, we get the evolution of banking, because those institutions, now actual organizations, from merchants, they start as merchants, then they evolve into money warehouses, and then they issue their own receipts, and in issuing their receipts, they become banks. And they begin then to issue more receipts than they actually have in deposits of the copper or the gold or whatever it is. And then they become fractional banks, fractional reserve banks. So you get the evolution of money, you get the evolution of banking. From the evolution of banking, you get all kinds of other financial intermediaries, insurance companies, pension companies, pension fund companies, mutual funds. Eventually you get stock markets, and you get the invention of all other kinds of financial assets, like bonds, bills, and notes, you know, very short-term, medium-term, and long-term loans, which are secured by these pieces of paper that we call bills, bonds, and notes.
Thank you, Professor Lewin, for kickstarting of what is going to be an intriguing discussion on monetary theory by giving us an insight on how the evolution of money took place from barter era to what we have today, paper bills, bonds, and notes. This definitely gives us a good base to build upon our discussion in a couple of weeks' time. Thank you so much for staying till the end and listening to the podcast. I hope you have enjoyed as much as I have bringing it to you. Please share it with your family and friends who would want to use this information to challenge the status quo and think from a different perspective. For more bite-sized information, follow me on Twitter at @TulipSNandu. And to receive interesting take on current topics, subscribe to my newsletter at tulip.substack.com. Until next time, go beyond the optics, friends.